Hi everyone, welcome to our seminar. Today we have two seminar presentations by our PhD visiting fellows. And the first one is by Patricia Funduka, who's visiting us from the University of Pretoria, where she's a PhD student, and she will present her work on social stratification and intergenerational mobility in Africa. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, UNU WIDA, for the PhD fellowship and also for giving me this opportunity to present my work. The title of my presentation is Stratification and Intergenerational Mobility in Africa, Examining Linkages with Pre-Colonial African Society. So in terms of the outline of my presentation, I'll first provide a brief background or motivation, go to the objectives, the methodology, data, and present some of the results I've obtained thus far. So there's been quite a bit of work which looks at how historical events have impacted on development and growth. So of particular relevance to Africa, we have the work of Asomugwu Johnson and Robinson, who look at how colonial origin led to differences in institutional development and led to differences in growth between countries. We also have the work of Ginaioli and Reina, and Michalopoulos and Papiano, who look at how centralization in pre-colonial African societies have led to differences in growth between other countries. So in this paper, I tried to look at, to provide a different way of looking at intergenerational mobility in Africa. So I tried to look at it from a historical perspective, and for those of you who are not in this field, mobility studies generally look at the relationship between the socioeconomic status of the parents and the socioeconomic outcome of the children as adults. And in this paper, I use education as the measure of socioeconomic status because it's the most widely available form of data for African countries, and also because it is relatively easier to measure across generations. So when you look at the mobility literature, a lot of papers have shown evidence of long-term persistence across multiple generations. For example, Clark uses the surname distribution in Sweden to show that the Swedish elite of over two centuries ago is still an elite in the society. They're still occupying the top occupations, and in terms of education as well, they're still occupying those top roles. Then Lindahl and Adamol also show how long-term persistence across multiple generations within families in terms of status. And so in this paper, I tried to compare intergenerational mobility between pre-colonial ethnic groups. And so this is like an intra-group mobility sort of perspective. And it is closely linked to the concept of the earth class, which was put forth by Gordon. So the concept of the earth class basically says that an individual's lifestyle, their behavior, and even the opportunity set that is available to that individual is determined by the individual's class position within the ethnic group. So basically, the ethnic group is an important unit of analysis, and there's been quite a few studies in mobility which have taken this sort of approach. For example, the study of Nimona study looks at studies intergenerational mobility within Black South Africans, and Chetty looks at intergenerational mobility between Black and white Americans, and Valdivieso looks at intergenerational mobility within white working class youths in the UK. We also think it's important to look at it from the ethnic group perspective for Africa because of the salience of ethnicity on the African continent. So it's like the importance of ethnicity for Africa. As has been noted by Bates, in most of the African countries, ethnic membership is used as a basic structure around which the political and social activities are organized usually. And also, like, if you look at it from the instrumentalist approach to ethnicity, then ethnicity has been used as a tool from the colonial period to the post-colonial period to access resources. Hence, this means it's important to analyze mobility even with the ethnic group perspective. When you look at the sort of like the literature on the historical development of Africa, you see that there's evidence of stratification in the pre-colonial African societies, and there's also evidence of stratification in the colonial period. And when you look at the African groups that have been in existence from this period, you can see that there's a linkage in that For example, like we still have the traditional elite in the African societies, and they have existed from the pre-colonial period. We also have the peasantry who are still like in the rural areas, and they have also been in existence from the pre-colonial period. So with each sort of like shock to the African continent, new classes or groups are emerging, but the same groups are still in existence from the pre-colonial period. We still have the same groups in existence along with new ones that emerged with each shock to the African continent. So in this paper, the overall objective is to examine the relationship between stratification in pre-colonial African societies and intergenerational mobility in contemporary Africa. So we specifically first want to see whether there's any observable trend between the intergenerational persistence levels within countries and the type of pre-colonial society that was dominant in that country. And we also examine the differences in mobility between ethnic groups which had different pre-colonial societies. Okay. So in terms of the econometric framework, we use the Baker and Toms model, which is like the standard mobility model, and where we have as the dependent variable, we have the child's education. As the independent variable, we have the parents' education, but we also introduce the ethnic classification of the ethnic group which the individuals belong to. And we interact that with parental capital to see if there are differences in sort of persistence between ethnic groups based on which classification they belong to, based on the pre-colonial classification they belong to. We complement this work using mobility matrices and transitional matrices, which are standard in the mobility sort of like literature. So the main source of data for the country level analysis is the World Bank. So we use nationally representative household surveys, which collect data on, retrospective data on parental education, and for which we're also able to determine the ethnicity of the respondents. And we have six countries in the country level analysis, which is we have Niger, Madagascar, Guinea, Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. And in terms of the control variables, we have age, household size, gender, ethnic group, region of residence, and religion which the individuals belong to.
So what's the difference between ethnic classification and ethnic group?
Okay, so the ethnic classification is a more composite measure. So for example, like within a country, you would have like maybe you have 10 ethnic groups, and two of them will belong to one classification and three are in another classification. So that's...
It's more aggregated.
Yeah, it's more aggregated. Yeah, it's a more composite measure. So in terms of the sort of like the ethnographic data that we use to see the type of stratification that existed in the pre-colonial time, we use a Murdoch's ethnographic atlas. So it captures the culture of the African societies in the pre-colonial period before colonialism. And it's been used before in quite a number of research, and I just mentioned some here. I just highlight some which are relevant for our study. And so basically, like Murdoch collected a lot of different attributes of the pre-colonial African societies. But what is relevant for us is what he calls the class stratification system in the society. So that's the class stratification system in the society. So he basically grouped like all 800 plus ethnic groups in Africa into five classifications. So we had, and then we further grouped them into two classifications. So we had rigid societies where parental status was easily transmitted to the children, and where there was also like it was... From the way he described it, it was very difficult for individuals to move up to another class in the society. So we classified the dual and elite as rigid societies, and then we had the fluid societies for which an individual was able to move up in society based on their effort. So these ones are where you could change your occupation based on like your abilities, like your bravery, etc. So we tried to cross-validate Murdoch's classifications in terms of like how he describes the cultures. So I tried to cross-validate this with the human relations area files that are stored at Yale University. So I picked selected groups and tried to read up on the culture of the group and see how that matches to Murdoch's. And this data set has also been cross-validated by a lot of other users who have used it. So for us to link the ethnic groups to the countries, like the pre-colonial ethnic groups to the countries, we use the data set we use the data set from Michalopoulos and Papiano to link the ethnic groups to the countries. So in terms of the actual distribution, as you can see here, Africa was a mix of different types of societies. We can see that in terms of like the Dior and elites, they were mostly in the Sahara region, the northern African region. But what comes out from this graph is that if within the different countries, we had different types of societies which were brought together when Africa was partitioned into countries. So for us to be able to compare how this relates to mobility in the present day, we had to create an index which showed which was the dominant type of pre-colonial society. Was it the fluid or the rigid? And so this is what we did. So we can see, and then we compared that to sort of like measures of mobility, like education mobility from the World Bank, which is the global database on intergenerational mobility. So we're able to sort of map how mobility has been evolving in Africa from the 1940s birth cohort to the 1980s, and compare that with the type of pre-colonial classifications that was in existence. So we see that there's an interplay between colonial origin and geographic factors when you look at the relationship to the pre-colonial African societies. You can see that, for example, in the sort of like the southern part of Africa, irrespective of the type of pre-colonial society, most of them were former British colonies, and they all have high levels of mobility, except the two former Portuguese colonies, which are Angola here and Mozambique, and this is Madagascar, obviously, it was a French colony. And then, but we can see like for the West African part, the countries which had rigid pre-colonial societies also exhibit high levels of persistence. We then also try to look at how this now relates to various measures of inequality, which is education inequality and income inequality, which is the Great Gatsby curve. And when we plot all the countries together, we can see that the relationships are different. And then we separate them into fluid or rigid societies. And for education inequality, there's no differences between the fluid or rigid societies. But when you look at income inequality, we can see that there seems to be a much steeper gradient of slope for the rigid societies as compared to the fluid societies. So in my paper, I go into more details on how I try to look at colonial origin and all that, but I will not present this here because of time. Then, so now we go to the country level analysis. So we had, those are the six countries that I mentioned, and of these, only two had a fluid sort of like dominant pre-colonial societies, so which is Guinea and Malawi. And we can see that Ghana has the highest mean years of education, followed by Nigeria, and the French colonies are more or less lagging behind. So for the regression analysis, I'll only present the results from the interaction because I think these are like the main results. I tried to keep the base constant. I tried to keep the absence. So I use all the five separate classifications for this regression analysis. So it's not the aggregated measure. So we have got the free man, the wealth, and all the other groups. And the foreign is people who, because in the survey, they identified themselves as either English or French. So I could not lump those with the other local groups because they had very different sort of like years of education compared to the local groups. So when you look at the interaction, the base was mainly the free men, apart from Guinea, where the sample for the free men was so small that it could not compute the standard errors. So for them, I used the wealth distinct, who are also another fluid sort of ethnic group. And what you can see is that in the red is the former British colonies, and in the blue is the former French colonies. So you can see that for the former British colonies, that the persistence among the dual ethnic group is much lower than the persistence among the free men. While for the former French colonies, all of them have had, in the dual group that have high levels of persistence as compared to the base. So what this means, what I interpret this as meaning, is that the persistent, because like you expect to find higher levels of persistence within the dual ethnic group because it was a more rigid society. And so for me, what this means is that the persistence, the rigidities in the society from the pre-colonial period seems to have continued in the former French colonies, while in the British colonies, the situation has changed. The dual societies are now more mobile as compared to the other groups. So the overall F statistic was significant, and we tested the interactions, the individual interactions for significance, and there were also significance. So for the rest of my presentation, I'll only focus on two other countries, which is Malawi and Madagascar, because they have sort of like a similar distribution and the interaction was significant. So we plotted the margins plot, which basically shows the average years of schooling for the children for specific years of education of the parents for the different classifications. And we can see that the slopes are all different, indicating that the interactions are significant. And we also see that the interaction is disordinal, meaning that at some point they interact. So according to the statistics, like if there's a disordinal interaction, then it means it's very important for you to interpret the results for the different groups separately and not just put them all together. What was interesting for me was that for the foreign, they had much higher levels of education than for the local ethnic groups. And this was also the case for Guinea, where we had the foreign group that also had like an ordinal sort of interaction, which for me indicates that the continuance of the sort of like the ranked societies, even in modern day, in the contemporary day. Then from here, so you can see we had to, like if you have the disordinal interaction, then you then have to like identify which are the regions of significance, like for which regions is the interaction significant. So we use the Johnson-Neyman procedure, which basically states that the further away from sort of like the intersection point it is, the more significant it is. So you can see that for Madagascar, like the interaction seems to be more significant at higher levels of education. And for Malawi, it's more significant at the lower levels of education. So what does this mean? Like for example, so Malawi was significant at the lower levels of education. So when you look at the transition matrices, which map the probability of children remaining in the same category as their parents or moving up, we can see that for Malawi, like when you use the country level estimate to measure the transition matrices, it shows that, for example, if your father had no education, then about 21% of their children have no education. But then when you break this down to the ethnic groups, we see it's 21% of the free men have no education, but it's only 8% of the duo have no education. So this is quite a big difference. And then for Madagascar, where the interaction was significant at higher levels, we see that when you use the country level estimates, of up to like around 80% of, like if your father had tertiary, 80% have secondary or higher. But when you break it down to the pre-colonial ethnic classification, you can see that only like for the free men, about 50% have secondary and post-secondary, and the dual has much higher levels of education. So it means this is where the differences are at that. So the slopes are actually different. The persistent levels are different for the different ethnic groups. So in conclusion, I'll say that what we see is that there seems to still be some linkages from the pre-colonial African societies to contemporary Africa. And we see that the dual societies are generally more mobile in the former British colonies, while the pre-colonial rigidities are still in existence in the former French colonies. And so whatever happened in the colonial period was key to how the pre-colonial societies evolved into the contemporary Africa. So, and from the mobility and transition matrices, we can see that the country level analysis masks vast differences in intragroup mobility. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, comments? Okay.
was it's a really interesting question, and your take on it is, I think, a big contribution. Actually, it was your last slide that I wanted to come back to, because until that last slide, I was coming away with the idea that your message was different to people like Asimov and Robinson and Nunn, because you were identifying that there were these structures in the pre-colonial era whose legacy persisted until the post-colonial era, but you were identifying that there's a difference between how French and British colonies actually dealt with these different structures. So that's an important finding. I guess the main comment I had was a very basic one, which is the standard constructivist criticism, which you can perhaps you engage with this in the paper, that when you're talking about identifying ethnic groups in the context of sub-Saharan Africa, this identification process in itself is political. So whether you recognize a particular group as a distinct ethnic group, or whether you recognize a particular group as having being rigid or being fluid, these are politically determined processes, and you have to ask yourself, you used to have to interrogate the source of these processes and discuss them, because I imagine that for area specialists, they're going to wonder about these classifications, particularly when you aggregate from the ethnic group to the country level. As you already identified, there are these intergroup, intra-country differences between groups that may well reflect the measurement error that whoever compiled the data set actually was guilty of.
Okay, thank you for that comment. Thank you for that comment. I do agree that there's like a lot of there's a possibility for measurement error, because the way I sort of classified them was very subjective. But I did try to, I tried to cross-validate the sort of like cultures of the ethnic group using the human relations area files at Yale University. But your comment is still valid, and I'll probably read a bit more on how I can deal with the issue. Yeah.
Ask a follow-up. So I'm not familiar with the social mobility literature, but it struck me that education, which you're using as your outcome or dependent variable as an indicator for mobility. It also struck me, though, that this is, we often think of education as an independent variable for explaining how mobility or rigidity is overcome. I don't know how this issue is dealt with. There's some level of endogeneity here conceptually, if we're thinking of education both as the measure of mobility and also as a driver of mobility. I don't know how the literature deals with it, because I'm not familiar with it, but you could probably know.
That's a pretty tricky question. I think the way education and the mobility, it's sort of like it's used as an indicator. Like, I think the main measure is usually like income. Like, we expect that it's used an indicator of someone's eventual outcome, like in their life. So, like, for example, like usually in the economic literature, they'll prefer to use income as mobility measure or occupation. But then for African countries, that data is generally not available. So, and it could be an endogenous variable, but our results are associations. We're not saying it's a causal effect, so it's an association. Like, if you're in this ethnic group, you're associated with that sort of thing. But I will try to read
it
more.
Sure,
but it's an
answer,
indicator
just,
of
I'm
outcome.
I'm familiar with what,
yeah,
how they deal with this issue of mobility,
yeah,
as education being both a driver and an outcome of mobility.
Yeah. Okay, I will read more on it. But I think it's been used in a lot of studies, and it's,
yeah, it sounds like it's quite,
yeah,
acceptable.
I had a question, and Albert Anderson has just got a paper out in NBR Working Papers, which is called the best paper I once sees on education movement in Africa. So they're using very granular data, much below country level data, and they're finding quite big spatial difference within country education movement. I forget exactly what data says they're using, but it's not the standard data sets that you have to look back in others.
Okay.
So I was wondering that if you see within country variation mobility, variation mobility, how is that correlated with your ethnic group dispersion of where they are? Because that is a confounding factor, right? I mean, they are a particular part of the country where you're seeing special differences. There may be other things that could be driving that association. So I think it's worth looking at that paper and seeing what data they're producing and see if you can replicate that in your analysis with that data set.
Okay, do you know, sorry, okay, I'll
send you the paper.
Yeah, okay, all right. Now that's an important observation. Like obviously, like I said, like the colonial period was key to how this sort of like ethnic groups evolved in terms of education. And you can see, like for example, for Ghana, the dual groups were more along the coast, which is where the missionaries were more also. So probably that also led to them having like higher levels of education compared to the freemen who were in the interior. So your comment is very valid, but I tried to control for region, so I had like region fixed effect, so I don't know if that would be enough to sort of cover the regional differences.
Just a quick comment. I think the environmental issues such as schooling resources in within country and also like across countries play a very important role in determining whether, you know, like how high the intergenerational mobility of education is. So I don't know if you have seen, like, do you have like any data on that, and then maybe like incorporate that into your analysis. So that might be able to explain like why some like the betas are like so different in one country and not the others.
Okay.
And that might be a confounding factor because, you know, maybe that specific origin may have like different levels of schooling resources, for example.
So it's a bit like different regions have different sort of like schooling infrastructure, and that's affecting their mobility. Okay, I think usually like the schooling resources are determined at the national level, so we wouldn't expect to have like they determine how much each region should get, so we shouldn't expect to have too many differences, but like we do control for urban and rural areas because there's like a significant difference.
Do you have like data like across town, for example?
No.
Even if you have like two periods of town and at a national level you can calculate the growth.
Okay.
Of, you know, like for example, you know, specific country have like a higher growth of maybe like, let's say the country construct more school with time, for example, and that might explain why, you know, their rates are so low, for example, because then schooling would reduce the mobility. More schooling infrastructure will increase the mobility.
Okay, I'll look into it to see if I can find some source which has like probably like this number of schools constructed in the different region, like at the time of the surveys. Okay.
And maybe in his comment to add, if there is like the distance from school to household, if you have this type of information, probably can also reflect how better education can be within household, depending on the distance they are from the school.
Okay, I will check the LSMS data set to see if they collect that information.
For now, similar line is abolition of school fees or reduction in school fees, because in some of these countries it's based in the 90s especially, but I assume there is variation across your countries.
Yes, because I didn't pull the data. It was like country specific, and you're right about the abolition. Like most of these countries have like free primary education and all that, but the literature identifies that in some countries, like even though the education is actually free, there are still some costs to the parent, which was still like, for example, they probably have to do some sort of like parent teach. They call them PTA contributions. They have to buy uniforms and bags, so that will still lead to those children not being in the schools.
Okay.